The Federal Trade Commission is finalizing a multi-pronged lawsuit against Amazon. The suit is expected to target the $1.3 trillion company's logistics and advertising arms, among other things. The lawsuit is expected to be filed as early as next month. If successful, it could mean breaking up parts of Amazon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use Amazon a lot? Do you try to avoid it? Do you find it hard to buy stuff that you need without going to Amazon? Do you think it should be considered a monopoly? Would you like to see it broken up? And if you sell stuff on Amazon, love to hear from you. What do you see as the pros and cons? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter Carstensen is an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. He's an expert in antitrust law and competition policy and a senior fellow of the American Antitrust Institute. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
A lot of our listeners are familiar with Amazon as a place to buy stuff. Putting on the antitrust lens, though, what does Amazon look like from that perspective?
Well, it looks like a very large company that seems to be very dominant in certain areas, the logistics, the online kind of buying and selling, and some of the other services that it provides seem to be ones in which it has very substantial market power.
What when it comes to antitrust regulation, you know, having a lot of power is one thing. Having enough for an agency like the Federal Trade Commission to convince courts that it's a problem is another. What kind of standard do we have to rise to have a successful antitrust litigation against a big company like Amazon?
That's the $100 million, or I should say $100 billion question always, because courts can be very different in their perspectives about what's involved, what needs to be shown. Basically, the concept of a violation of Section 2, that's the anti-monopoly provision of antitrust law, is that you have to show that a firm either has or is attempting to acquire a, quote, monopoly position. Well, monopoly in law does not mean having 100% of the market. Mm-hmm. It means having dominance, very substantial dominance of the market. And when I say very substantial, notice that that's inherently a variable concept. Cases have tended to say a firm with 50% or less of a market is probably not a monopolist. Although if it is seeking to acquire a monopoly by driving others from the market, it could be an attempted monopolist. When you get over 70 or 80% of a market, that's generally thought by courts to constitute a monopoly market position. One of the problems with that is that it assumes that we can figure out who's competing with whom. And so there are other ways of thinking about it, especially does a firm have significant power over the prices that it charges? That is, it can charge a number of different prices for its goods, make a profit, and so it has a lot of discretion that way. And does it have the ability to drive competitors from the market by its pricing and other practices, even if we're not quite sure whether what it monopolizes? It has, if it meets those two criteria, a monopoly position in the market, and so we're again concerned about its conduct and maybe even its market structure.
Talking to Peter Carstensen. He's an antitrust expert, emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Law School, talking about Amazon, likely lawsuits coming from the Federal Trade Commission for antitrust action against the giant internet company and other stuff company. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your opinions on this, your experiences. Now, Peter, from a consumer experience, I might say, okay, yeah, I could buy stuff on Amazon. I could buy stuff on a store's website. I could go to a big box store or my local grocery store for a lot of things. To me, as a consumer, maybe that doesn't feel like a monopoly. Is that relevant to what you expect to see from the FTC, though?
First of all, yes, that is exactly the issue that one needs to think about. If consumers are not seeing that their options are foreclosed, that sounds as if you're saying maybe from a consumer perspective, it's not a problem. But there are other perspectives. Suppliers of goods and services, one of the repeating concerns with Amazon is that it has induced a number of small and middle-sized businesses to use its services, and that it then puts them in a situation where their ability to compete is significantly reduced and controlled, so that Amazon, in effect, forecloses competition in the supply market rather than in the consumer market, because the other entities you've suggested are all very large enterprises. So that the mom and pop business, the small business that is trying to build itself, needs to use platforms like Amazon, and indeed, are there other platforms that they can use? That would be an important question to ask.
And that seems like it's going to be key to this lawsuit. If I have a widget company, Rob's Widgets, and I'm selling on Amazon, Amazon rules say I have to sell my widgets at the cheapest price possible on Amazon. I can't charge more there than in other platforms. And if I want them to show up on the widget search ahead of other companies, I got to pay to that. I have to advertise on Amazon. Is that the kind of market power that that could get Amazon into trouble?
Yes, that's exactly the kind of scenario where you look at that and say, well, wait a minute now. If you're offering to run a marketplace and then charging people for their positions in the market and restricting their freedom to compete, and they comply with both of those requirements, those are significant restrictions on their ability to compete. How can you do that? You can only in the business world, that only makes sense if your position, in this case, Amazon's position, is such that many users have no choice but to use Amazon. So that would be the kind of thing that the FTC might well focus on.
Another complaint I've heard in the past, and I haven't seen it talked about in terms of this impending lawsuit, is the idea, okay, my widgets, Rob's widgets, they're selling great on Amazon. Amazon has all my customer data. They could say, hey, these things are looking good. We'll make our own off-brand widgets. We'll sell them for a little bit less than Rob's, and we'll bump them up on the search. If it can be shown, and it seems like it'd be hard to show that, if it can be shown that Amazon practices in this way, undercuts, in effect, its own supplier customers, is that a risk of antitrust action?
Oh, absolutely. And indeed, you're right. That has been an issue that Amazon gets because of its logistical system, an enormous amount of data about what products are being sold, and it can then calculate what the margins are, what makes the most sense in terms of its business model to try to take over. And again, if I am in a situation we talked about a minute ago, in which I have to use Amazon, that is, it's by a substantial margin the first best alternative, now I'm subject to yet another competitive risk and potential competitive harm that I will now be squeezed out of the business. And my recollection is that there is an example of that in history involving an online diaper supply company. But I confess that I didn't go back this morning to go and look for that article and try to resurrect more specific information.
And then another angle in this I've mentioned is logistics, meaning in this case, I think how things get delivered. And so staying with my widget company, I want to ship by UPS, FedEx, US Postal Service or something. And one of the accusations against Amazon is they're saying you're going to pay a penalty if the stuff doesn't show up on our Amazon vans. Is that, again, actionable?
If the facts show that Amazon is again using, notice that we all come back to the leverage that somehow I have to be on the Amazon platform. And then it's using that power to exploit me, or you in this case, I should say, exploit you by forcing you to use their logistics when FedEx, UPS, the post office, given you're only selling widgets, which I thought were limited to law school classrooms anyway.
And business school.
Okay. But you think that you would be better off using another delivery system in some locations or for some of your products. And here Amazon has interfered with that freedom. That, you see, is partly, on one hand, it helps to prove the existence of their monopoly power. On the other hand, it's an adverse effect on competition in that other delivery services, other logistical services are precluded from competing for your business where they would offer a better product, better service, lower cost. So that kind of, we're linking together both the harms and the proof of the problem, proof of the power as well.
Talking to UW-Madison Law School Emeritus Professor Peter Carstensen about a likely federal antitrust suit against Amazon. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Amazon has unfair advantages, especially in the online marketplace? Do you want to see Amazon and maybe even other big technology companies more regulated, maybe split up? Or from your perspective as someone who buys on Amazon, maybe even sells on Amazon, do things work pretty well for you? You want to see them stay the way they are? Call in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison Law School Emeritus Professor Peter Carstensen about a likely Federal Trade Commission antitrust suit against Amazon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about Amazon and antitrust law? Do you want to see the government in general be more aggressive at breaking up big companies that have monopoly power or close to it? Join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Peter, one more angle in this story, broken, by the way, by Politico. They report that Amazon Prime could be another target. It bundles books, music, and video streaming. The FTC worried, apparently, that bundle of services, I'm quoting from Politico here, is used to, quote, illegally cement the company's market power. This is the one I got to say I understand the least. Does that make sense to you?
Right. You and me both. I think the idea, and it goes back to our example of your widget business, that is, we're looking at something where they're combining a bunch of valuable services so that customers really are tied in an economic, psychological sense, to using this to the exclusion of alternatives. And then Prime, as I recall, has you pay for it. So now, again, we're trying to create barriers, or they are trying to create barriers to competition, both in kind of the core distribution of goods and services element, but also then trying to preempt more of the market for the other services that they're offering, whether it's music or a video or whatever. And so, again, this is a situation where, from one perspective at least, you're looking at it and saying you're using means that foreclose, again, competition on the merits for each of these different services. And there's no particular reason, in terms of technological logic, that you have to combine all of these things. If you leave them separate, then there are there are three or four different domains in which there can be competition, and you can have more different alternatives.
Looking at the big picture of the rise and fall of antitrust actions by the federal government, where are we right now? It seems like we've had heydays a century ago with the trust busters, the big breakup of AT&T half a century ago. Lately, though, it seems like a tall order. We're hearing about this Microsoft acquiring Activision. The FTC tried to stop it. Doesn't look like they're going to be successful. Is this a tough time to break up big businesses?
It is less of a tough time than it was 10, 20 years ago. That is, we had a real falling off of antitrust enforcement, starting with the Reagan administration, mild recovery through thereafter, but not really bringing it back to what I am someone who is very strongly pro-antitrust enforcement, just to make sure my own point of view is clear on this, but not being brought back to that level. The Biden administration has taken a much more activist view on paper. And we've seen many more cases being filed. And what's really important and is much less visible, a number of transactions have been abandoned, either at the point when there's a serious investigation or where the Justice Department or the Trade Commission says, we're going to sue you. And the response is, oh, no, you're not, because we're not going to do that. So we've seen more success. And one of the ways you can tell is that the actual size of most mergers has declined significantly. That is, mergers are going forward, but the targets are a lot smaller, which means that the emphasis is that major mergers are going to be blocked. We're seeing somewhat more active involvement in the monopoly area. That's what we're talking about here with Amazon. The Trade Commission just today settled a major monopoly case involving a prescription drug distribution where they say they're going to get a good remedy. So I'd say we're seeing a more active effort to enforce. It's not going to always be successful. There have been some major losses. And the courts are a real stumbling block here from, again, my perspective, because they are not paying as much attention to what the law actually says as I think they ought to.
Talking to Peter Karstensen, UW-Madison Law School Emeritus Professor, looking at antitrust activity, an expected lawsuit from the Federal Trade Commission against Amazon. We got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, Amazon is the only thing that actually works. I save money and time. How about we break up U.S. oil cartels, pharmaceutical and insurance monopolies? There's a lot better things to break up than Amazon. So Matt taking that, you know, what does it mean for the consumer angle here? Peter, what do you think of what he has to say?
Well, my first reaction is I'm not at all sure that consumers are going to see anything worse from as a result of this lawsuit. First, the lawsuit's going to take years, assuming it's filed, to be resolved. Secondly, the question is, what's the resolution that occurs? And my experience, and I had 5 years in actual antitrust enforcement back many years ago, to be sure. But my bad experience and my subsequent observation is government enforcers are very, very concerned to make sure that they really don't create problems. I know that in the AT&T case, not one that I was involved in, but I know from people who were there that some of the biggest concerns came from the antitrust division. Gee, if we break up AT&T, are we going to make the world worse? Well, of course, we made the world so much better. Things that AT&T had suppressed for years came out, like cell phones. So I think one should not be concerned very much. Some concerns legitimate, but that I think it's unlikely that whatever remedy might be reached, assuming a violation is found, that it will have any significant adverse effect on consumers.
One argument I've seen over the last decade, I think, or so, Peter, is there's something different about technology and internet-based things where you need a critical mass of customers or social media users or what have you. So monopoly laws, antitrust laws don't really apply to these things. They don't work unless they get to a certain size. What do you think?
I think that's a real problem to be looked at, because indeed there are these effects, the network effect, the need for scale. Partly it's thinking about where do we need scale? Where can we have independent operations? A project I'm working on, I've been working on for a long time with a colleague, has been looking at what some of the alternatives are for dealing with these technological bottlenecks. How can we create ownership of the bottlenecks that will make them as open as possible and will allow competition to flourish in the parts that don't require substantial market power? And the phone system is one example. The internet itself is a wonderful example of how we've got a system that is a single system, but it's accessible to many people, many platforms. So it requires understanding the technology and figuring out how it can be made as competitive, as consistent with competition as possible.
In just our last half a minute or so, Peter, you mentioned this could take a long time. Assuming this antitrust action is filed next month, how long, what steps are there along the way till it gets resolved?
Oh, it would be filed, and it's not clear whether they would file it in court or as an administrative agency matter. Either way, litigation of this sort takes many years. I'd say 3 years, depending on the judge or the administrative law judge, 3 years, 4 years to trial, to judgment. And then if it takes an appeal, as there is likely to be, that's another 2 or 3 years. If you have to go all the way to the Supreme Court, it's going to be at least another 3 years. So you're looking at maybe a 7-year process, and that's a very rough guess. Now, at various stages, they can settle this case, and that's what I would actually expect is very likely to happen is some kind of settlement.
Peter, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
That's Peter Carstensen, emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Law School. He's an expert at antitrust law. He talked to us about likely Federal Trade Commission antitrust lawsuits against Amazon. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. 6 out of the 10 most viewed videos on YouTube are marketed towards kids. Baby Shark sits very comfortably at the number one spot. I'll spare you that soundbite, though. YouTube is full of kids' content that tries to get the attention of children and of the site's algorithm with bright colors and hot buzzwords. And even with the child filters on, it's difficult for YouTube to effectively sift and winnow through millions of videos to decide what's safe and appropriate for kids to watch. It's pretty much impossible for that algorithm to figure out what's truly educational or beneficial. What do parents need to know? We've got a Wisconsin expert on kids' media with us, and we'll find out what PBS Wisconsin has to offer, too. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do your kids watch YouTube? How old are they? What rules and restrictions do you have in place to keep them safe? Have you found them watching a lot of annoying video or even something that you found concerning? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Heather Kerkorian is director of the Cognitive Development and Media Lab at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Heather, thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And Jen Kobolecki is associate director of education engagement at PBS Wisconsin. Jen, thanks for coming over to the radio side of Wisconsin Public Media.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
Heather, let's start with you. Kids, statistics show, I've seen it in my own extended family, they're watching a lot of YouTube. How important is it for us to study what kids are doing with YouTube and what's out there for them?
Yeah, YouTube is definitely the most commonly used media. So video content is the most common media for kids. And within that, YouTube is by far the most commonly used platform for young kids. And the average in the U.S. for kids under 8 is about 2.5 hours per day, based on our most recent estimates. So it's a substantial amount of time for kids.
And anybody who uses YouTube, as I do, know YouTube suggests things for you and sometimes autoplays things for you next. What do we know about the kind of content that kids get, especially younger kids, if they're parked in front of YouTube for more than 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, so part of the algorithm is driven by just what's most popular. So part of what you see is driven by what other people are seeing and clicking on. But it's also based on what you've been clicking on. So depending on whether kids are using a device that's just for them or a shared device that maybe their parents use too, logged into the same account, what they see might partly depend on their parents' or other family members' viewing history as well.
And a lot of your work deals with how kids interact with media. And that's part of the story here, right? Because they might click on the next shiny story. Does that I don't know, does that make kids connect more with the YouTube media they're watching, for better or worse?
Yeah, so often what's promoted are things that YouTube and Google think that you're likely to click on and enjoy watching. Whether you actually have positive emotional responses to it or not is a different question, but you'll keep watching, and that's the most important thing for them. So for sure, the things kids are likely to click on are things that Google thinks they're likely to keep watching.
We'll dig more into the content that kids encounter. But Jen, I want to bring you in now. You're with PBS Wisconsin. You work on creating and spreading content that will be helpful and beneficial for kids. Can you talk about, first of all, the kind of content for younger kids that you offer via PBS Wisconsin?
Absolutely. Well, it is a real honor to work with PBS Wisconsin because PBS creates really high quality content. It is back from the days of when Sesame Street was on the air, created with educators in the room before it's ever shot or animated. And we have researchers involved. These are all really, really smart people that are making media that is designed to help children learn. And that is just really a pleasure. So we do that. We share nationally produced media from PBS Kids, and we also make media for some older grades here in Wisconsin.
And you don't just broadcast it. There's a presence for PBS Kids and PBS Wisconsin on YouTube. How do you try to keep a nice, clean channel that that kids and parents can count on?
Well, being wherever kids and families are finding media is a great thing. So I don't have the expertise to speak to the tracking on the different platforms, but we are out there. We want to be able for families and kids to find us. And it's great content. It's free content. It's commercial free content, which I think is also a really important point.
Talking to Jen Kobielecki, Associate Director of Education Engagement at PBS Wisconsin, and Heather Kerkorian with the Cognitive Development and Media Lab at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. We're looking at programs created for kids, what's available on YouTube, options we have on PBS Wisconsin, and what happens when the YouTube algorithm takes over what kids are watching. You can join in as a parent. Do you have an experience with this? Is there a source of kids' media that you have come to trust and count on? Have you seen some weird stuff pop up on YouTube over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. There's some weird stuff on YouTube, maybe uncanny. Here's an example of a pretty popular one video. This is the third most watched video of all time on YouTube.
Johnny. Eating sugar.
No, Papa.
Telling lies.
Okay, I watched this for the first time. This is a kid eating sugar, hopefully out of a kitchen cabinet. This is the kind of kitchen cabinet where I would think cleaning supplies might end up a lot. It didn't look like something I would have wanted a little kid to watch when I was raising little kids. They're 20 now. They can watch what they want. What is good content for kids, Heather?
Yeah, it's a complicated umbrella of things. But so one of the most common things you'll find on YouTube for kids are music videos like the one you just played that are nursery rhymes or other kind of kid-friendly videos, and also things that we would classify as wish fulfillment. So unboxing videos where they see kids opening toys or eating candy, like the example you just shared. And those kinds of things I think of as kind of the junk food of video. They're not necessarily harmful in moderation, but they're probably not very educationally valuable either. What we would want to see more of for educational value are things that are designed around an educational curriculum. So not just dropping in the occasional mention of letters or numbers or things like that, but really a whole curriculum designed around that educational content.
Now, there was a wave of articles a few years back about worse than that, where online trolls basically would produce videos with popular characters like the Peppa Pigs and things like that, and end up with really disturbing and violent imagery. YouTube was at that point trying to crack down. I don't know how they're doing. Do you have a sense of if at least that hazard is less hazardous now?
Yeah, it's definitely gotten better. So back, you know, the videos you're talking about, and at that time, it was completely algorithm driven. It was all automated. So it was pretty easy to trick the algorithm into choosing content that wasn't necessarily for kids or wholesome for kids. Since then, Google's incorporated some human monitors who will both look at content that's been flagged as inappropriate on YouTube Kids, for example, but also do more proactive searching, so explicitly looking for that content. So it's reduced quite a bit.
Jen, you were talking about how content is developed here at PBS Wisconsin and with PBS Kids nationally. And Heather was mentioning, you know, what goes into making quality content. Can you talk a little more about the process, how we figure out how to make stuff that's educational for kids, but not so educational they're going to not want to watch it and watch the shiny nursery rhyme video instead.
Absolutely. I can speak to that. And I want to share too, Rob, that what's really important is not just the media itself and kind of plopping a child down in front of a screen to watch that media, but co-viewing media with your child or educators co-viewing media with their students and really helping them understand and navigate the learning that's embedded. That's really, really key to this process. But yeah, when we make media at PBS Wisconsin and when PBS Kids is making media, they are starting with a learning goal that they're trying to achieve. So I'll give you an example. There's a fairly new program on PBS Kids called Work It Out Wombats. It is a delightful show about a family of wombats that is trying to solve many problems. The learning goal that is embedded in that show is around computational thinking. You may not, that may not mean anything to you if you're wondering what that is. You use computational thinking all the time. If you have ever followed a recipe, that is computational thinking. You're doing things in a certain order. If you've ever troubleshot a problem and thought about, well, how do we make a solution to this? Those are computational thinking skills. So PBS Kids is going to have researchers and experts on computational thinking involved in the making of that show, in the way that it's animated, even the poses of the characters, having thinking poses. And the scripts, of course, are going to support different aspects of computational thinking. And we are always testing with educators and kids. And that's true for the media we make at PBS Wisconsin Education as well.
And what age range are these wombats working for?
They are working for kids ages 2 through 8.
Excellent. And Heather, I wanted to follow up on that point that Jen made about co-watching, parents watching the media along with the kids, especially maybe when there's something new that they're seeing for the first time. How important is that?
It's really important, especially the younger the kids are, the more they really benefit from co-viewing, and both in terms of increasing the good stuff, like educational outcomes, but also decreasing bad stuff. So if young kids see something they find scary or they see stereotype content, then co-viewing with parents can help minimize the potential harms of that scary or harmful content too.
We're talking to Heather Kerkorian, cognitive development and children's media expert at UW-Madison, and Jen Kobolecki, PBS educational outreach specialist, PBS Wisconsin, I should say, educational outreach specialist. Talk about the often wild world of children's content on YouTube, how it compares to what's out there on TV, on public TV, and what parents need to know about their kids' media consumption. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember watching as a kid on TV? On YouTube, if you're young enough for that to have been out when you were a kid. Do you think it was beneficial for you? Do you feel like it rotted your brain a little bit? And if you're a parent yourself of young kids or have been recently, what was your policy on what they watched, how they watched, when they watched it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time.
This week on Beta, television and film critic Matt Zoller Seitz talks about David Milch's brilliant reinvention of the Western, Deadwood.
And I think as the show went on, I think it was always good right out of the gate, but the more female characters they added, the richer that part of the show became.
Saturdays at 11 and Sundays at 8 on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation about children's media on YouTube, how to know what's safe, what's educational. Our guests are Heather Kerkorian, media and cognitive development expert at UW-Madison, and Jen Kobolecki, associate director of education engagement at PBS Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen kids' content on YouTube that you think is good, that's benefited your child, or bad, less good, disturbing, or just annoying? Is there someplace you go to for something to watch, for your kids to watch, maybe to watch with your kids or your students? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rachel is with us in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi. Let's try that again. Rachel, are you there? There we go.
I am.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Rachel?
Yeah, so I am a Gen Z baby. I grew up watching early generations of YouTube. It was unfiltered. Things like Smosh came up where they have a line where it's, what's the expletive? And I'm glad that now generations are having YouTube Kids, especially myself as an educator, where kids are utilizing Blippi and other educational YouTube videos where it's censored for them, where they're not being introduced to harmful content for their brain when they're being exposed to things that aren't necessarily age appropriate or ready for them to be exposed to yet.
And Rachel, can I ask, what age do you teach? What grade do you teach?
I'll be teaching middle school, but I've often interacted with kids below the age of 6.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Rachel. And Jen, can you talk about your outreach to teachers just like Rachel?
Absolutely. Rachel, thanks for caring about these things and the work that you do to inspire young children. Like we were sharing before, Rob, what's really important is the adults that are co-viewing with their children. And so a lot of what we do to support educators in the early childhood space is to share how we can be effective media mentors and really have meaningful media integration. So kids love those characters that they see. They love the stories. And we can use that love and excitement as an entryway to more and deeper learning. So one of the things we do is we have a cohort of librarians from around the state over the past 3 years that have done training programs with our team that help them implement PBS Kids programming into their communities. And that looks like everything from doing story times to doing a farmer's market to having a PBS Kids corner. We have one librarian based in Sheboygan who has done amazing work. And she shared that the media clips that she shows have actually extended into conversations that happen in the home between the parent or caregiver and their child. And what we know is that when the adults in kids' lives are engaged, their learning is just so much more involved and effective. So those are the success stories we want to see. We do lots of other professional development around the state. We'll be doing some conferences in person around the state, and we have virtual trainings. Folks can go to pbswisconsineducation.org to check those out.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Heather, I think you've worked on a media literacy issues with kids. And I think of that as like kind of a complicated thing that maybe starts in high school. Am I wrong? Can we start inculcating media literacy at younger ages?
Yeah, we certainly can. And it can be very basic, even at the very early ages, just preschool age kids, even just focusing on, for example, commercial content versus program content. So what's the difference between an ad and what's the purpose of an ad versus the program they're actually watching? And sometimes the lines between those things are very blurred.
Let's go back to our callers now. Scott is with us in Wausau. Scott, hi.
Hi. Yeah, animated shorts are quite a good resource for kids. They're, you know, condensed 5-7 minutes. You usually don't have English, so you gotta have to pay attention, and usually a good story. Doesn't turn dark very often.
Do you have specific titles that you go for your kids? And I think I heard one of them in the background there, Scott.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The titles are just so varied. I mean, I think one of the channels is called CG Bros, but there's thousands of them. There's thousands of animated shorts.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Heather, for parents looking for something short like that, there's a lot out there, a massive variation in quality. What would you suggest people seek out?
The best recommendations for YouTube is to make sure you're using YouTube Kids, which is a subset of YouTube. It's not the YouTube main that we would just land on if we search for YouTube. And that does a lot of the filtering for you to get rid of the potentially harmful stuff, the vast majority of it. Within that, and I'm not just saying this because I'm with a bunch of public media folks right now, I promise, but my number one recommendation for parents is PBS Kids content, because it's some of the best content out there and it's freely available.
And for someone like Scott, Jen, who's looking for, say, animated bits in that 5 to 10 minute range, do you have stuff out there?
We absolutely do. And you can find those on pbswisconsin.org. We have our streaming there. We have lots of resources for parents to check out. You can turn on your television and see them there. You can go to YouTube Kids and find them. We also have lots of interactive. So there are games that families can play with their kids for a tablet. And just wonderful, wonderful resources. Those are all available on pbswisconsin.org.
Scott, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Heather, do we have numbers, time limits where we say, you know, whatever, however good the video content is, this is too much for a kid of age X?
Yeah. So the American Academy of Pediatrics has guidelines for that. And it's age-based. So they say for kids 18 months and younger, they recommend minimizing screen time to the extent possible, except for things like video chat, things that are socially interactive. For preschool age kids, kind of that 2 to 5 year old range, they recommend no more than an hour per day. My recommendation to parents is to think a lot more about what they do want their kids to do in the day, make sure they're getting enough sleep, make sure they're playing outside every day, make sure they're having undistracted, screen-free social interaction time, like at the dinner table. Once you cover those bases, I don't set a hard limit on screen time over that.
And Jen, if I have this right, a lot of the material from PBS Kids and PBS Wisconsin isn't just the video product. There's support materials in many cases so that there's something attached to it that isn't just watching the show.
Absolutely. And that's where a lot of our educator training comes in. We also have a huge catalog of self-paced on-demand learning that early childhood educators can access for free. For childcare providers especially, they can earn credit in a system called the Wisconsin Registry, where they track their professional development. And all of this is free. It's a way to learn how to use that media effectively with children and to help learn about media literacy and be a great media mentor for young children.
Heather, I wanted to talk about some of your research here. Now, as grownups, we take for granted. We can look at a screen and our brains interpret this two-dimensional surface into a three-dimensional story and, you know, the narrative stitches together. Our brains aren't necessarily born understanding that. What do we know about how, you know, those younger, infants and toddlers are dealing with this weird 2D window in their universe?
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. It violates a lot of the things we might expect based on our experience with the real world. The research shows that until about 2 years old, young kids really don't understand what screens are and what they represent. So they need a lot of help to make sense of it. Starting around 2 years old, kids start to understand really simple video content. But then there's a developmental trajectory there, and it's not until about 12 years of age that kids can understand, for example, a full-length Disney movie the way adults would.
Time for one more caller. David is with us in Rhinelander. David, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, it's not necessarily YouTube, but obviously, you know, there's streaming platforms out there, a bunch of them that are similar to YouTube. And my kids, one of his favorite shows is, and it's actually on Prime Video, is Blaze and the Monster Machines. He loves that show, and I really like it because it brings up a lot of concepts of physics and the science in general. Like in one episode, they talk about like tension on ropes as part of the show, or speed and aerodynamics, all kinds of things like that. And I just like that he can pick that stuff up from that show.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for the recommendation. Streaming a whole other part of the story. Jen, a science-related program where people can learn. These are big trucks, it looks like. Anything at in the PBS Kids world that you'd point toward for kids to learn some of those science principles?
Oh, there is so much there on that topic. Ready, Jet, Go is a program that has tons of great clips for kids to learn about the engineering design process, which is when you try to think of how I might build something, figure out where it doesn't work, revise, and then try again. There is also a great program called Eleanor Wonders Why, which is focused on science inquiry and how we can encourage our kids to be curious as they explore the natural world, as well as thinking about how they access informational texts to get answers to questions they may have about what they find out there.
David, thanks a lot for the call, and we'll leave it there. Thanks, Jen, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Ron.
I've been talking to Heather Kerkorian, director of the Cognitive Development and Media Lab at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, and Jen Kobolecki, associate director of education engagement at PBS Wisconsin. We talked to them about children's content on YouTube and what adults need to know before letting their kids watch, and some good alternatives, including from PBS Wisconsin and PBS Kids.